live from across Europe. This is Previously in Europe, a podcast of what's previously in Europe. I'm your co-host Hugh in London. I'm here with the co-host Kieran in Berlin. Say hello, Kieran.
We're just two friends who thought we'd record a conversation because we're just so crazy.
Yes, on another edition of the classic format of Two Dudes Talking podcast. This is a previously
classic
in Europe
genre.
Yeah, it is classic. It's the predominant genre of the. It's like if you're like, oh, what kind of band are you in? You're like, I'm in a rock band. You're like, what does that mean?
There is a guitar somewhere.
Yeah, right, exactly. It's not a band if there's no guitar, I've heard. Yes.
Take that, jazz.
Well, jazz can have guitars. I play jazz guitar. And this is not important. We're not... Stop it. This week, in an issue of our recurring segment, Also Happening, we talk about something that is also happening this week and also happening. Irish government formation. You might vaguely remember there was an Irish election months and months ago. There's still no government. And I'll talk about it briefly. It's created some peculiarities, legal peculiarities, where while in name, Leo Varadkar is going around the world, like, as... Well, he's not going around the world now because of COVID times, but he's presenting himself as, like, the leader of Ireland. But from a technical perspective, he is not Taoiseach anymore.
He's not Taoiseach.
Yeah.
No.
Which has created this problem where, like, the upper house of the Irish Parliament can't sit because it doesn't have, like, a lot of the members haven't been named because the Taoiseach has to name them. So
yeah.
There's vacant seats. There's a vacancy on one of the Irish criminal courts, so they can't sit. There's a whole thing where there being no Taoiseach is actually quite complicated. It's created some problems.
Nice.
And this is because the election was very much like a deadlock where no one particularly came out on top. There were big gains for Sinn Féin and other left parties. There was a big, big hit to the two major parties who generally have just been, you know, swapping power back and forth. There's no easy setup, which has previously usually been, like, has usually been the case before, where one of the two big parties, Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael, will be able to, if neither of them have a majority, will be able to get one other party to either cement their majority or get a majority in the first place, whereas that is not the case now.
Yeah.
And what I'm going to talk about now is the Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael, Green Party proposed coalition, which I have referred to as Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael want to eat their vegetables, but they want to do it as part of a very meat-heavy diet.
Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael want to eat their vegetables, and those vegetables are the Green Party.
Yes.
Consume it whole.
So this effectively, like, after a lot of back and forth of various possible governments that could theoretically be formed, this was always the most kind of plausible to happen, because it involved the fewest moving parts. Even though getting the moving parts to agree on anything was going to be quite difficult, it wasn't kind of like, oh, we need these four parties plus loads of independents who will all have their individual complaints. Seemed less feasible than this. So they've now gotten to the stage after many instances where it seemed like they weren't going to get to this stage in the first place. They've now published a program for government, and this needs to be approved by all three of the parties for it to move forward. And the one, I guess, we're focused on is the Green Party, because number one, they were by far the smallest party in this that would be in this coalition. They're kind of getting the least from it. And a lot of things that you would imagine as Green sticking points are either not addressed in this program of government or are addressed in a vague enough way that it can seem like it will be okay with the Green Party's plans, or is kind of like explicitly kind of like a no-go on various levels. I think, like, from the outset, I think my opinion of this is that the Green Party would be getting screwed quite heavily, which I suspect you agree.
Yes, absolutely, they would, 100%. And a lot of the Greens seem to agree. Should I go into the history of, like, how this exact same thing has happened before?
Yeah, that'd be great. That'd be really helpful.
Right. So, in the 30th Dáil, which This was the 2007 general election is when this government came into existence. The Greens went into power with one of the two monster parties, as I like to refer to them, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. They went into coalition with Fianna Fáil. And this government eventually gets scrapped and destroyed because of the 2008 financial recession and its effects in Europe, and particularly Ireland. But in the background of that, it also takes like this huge momentum that the Greens had started building, and then just completely destroys that without the recession. Because so outside of the leader at this time was a Ciarán Cuff. And outside of this, they basically managed to build support by attaching themselves to various movements. The Shell to Sea campaign, which was about getting rid of Royal Shell Company, the Dutch oil extraction company, out of Ireland, effectively. There were also plans to reroute the M3 motorway, which was a motorway that was going to disturb a historical site in Tara, one of Ireland's very like Neolithical tombs kind of thing. And they also attached themselves to the campaign to get rid of the United States military, who had been stationed at Shannon Airport for refueling reasons, for the sole reason that Ireland is meant to be a neutral country. So, yeah, why are the Americans here? Anyway.
Yes, and back at the time, that this was a very big deal, because by 2007, things like the Iraq War were very unpopular in... And, like, not that they were popular in the first place in Europe, but they had become increasingly unpopular.
And especially maybe because I think it had lasted this long.
Yes, it had lasted this long, and kind of, like, the winds had changed on, like, Tony Blair's government in the UK as well. And, and, like, attaching yourself to... like the anti-war movement in Ireland is kind of always a good shout, because there's a very high baseline support for it, as is not like oil drilling. So,
So I guess the thing that like really screwed over the Greens here is, and how much of this could be said to have been like Green leadership and, or the fact that they went into deal with Fianna Fáil, I say it's both. Is that they basically, there was no substantive changes on any of these three issues while they were in government with Fianna Fáil, including like really badly was the 2008 budget. There was no carbon levy introduced, which is like carbon levies is like the bare minimum you can do as a Green Party. In terms of like fighting climate change and stuff like that. And then you get into the whole deal of the Corrib gas project, which the Green Party at the previous annual conference, so I guess possibly the 2007-2006 annual conference, launched an inquiry into the irregularities surrounding the Corrib gas project, which was like not consulting the neighborhoods that they were building pipelines through, protesters to the project being arrested at the whims of Shell, the company. All great stuff. But then when they got into power in 2007, they immediately withdrew the inquiry. And the person in charge of the kind of like tokenistic green politician that was actually put in charge of the Corrib gas project, to make it look like this government cared about the environment, was Eamon Ryan. A figure we never heard from again.
Yes, for people who don't know, Eamon Ryan is now the leader of the Green Party. So this is something that kind of... there's a recurring thing on this podcast, talking about European politics generally, that... almost every country in Europe has a Green Party, and the kind of like quote unquote goodness of the Green Party differs quite wildly country to country. So like in a lot of Eastern Europe, you have like agrarian Green Parties that aren't actually what they would appear. They're not like super like pro environmental legislation in the way we would think of them. And then you've various ones like the German Greens, which are like very, very wedded to like deficit reduction and aren't really for government spending. They're more
and the German auto industry. As
yeah,
well.
Yeah, they're close to the, exactly. They're like very close to the German auto industry and like, you know, not as anti-coal as you would expect a Green Party to be. I also have to say, like, everyone in the German Greens would be pro the German auto industry. It's just like the party as a whole isn't operating in a way that you would expect that if they got into a coalition that they would be pushing these things very hard.
My theory around all this would be that, like, well, first I think we have to kind of like separate, and what you're kind of talking about is there is a difference between like leadership and the actions undertaken by leadership versus membership, as well as like the PR campaigns that they do. Like, there's the things the Greens say about themselves, and then there's the things the Greens do.
Yeah.
And then there's the things that the junior membership or the grassroots level would like them to do. The classic example of this is, like, the Green Party of Austria basically pushed out their youth wing because their youth wing was too radical for their liking.
So
things like that. And... My theory on this is that it's actually more a lot of what determines the goodness of a Green Party is how far or close to power they are. Because, like, one of the best Green Parties in terms of, like, what they have on paper and what they've done is, like, the UK Green Party or the England and Wales Green Party. Like, people pointed out they've had, like, positions as equally radical as, like, Jeremy Corbyn's. But they've just been so, so far from power. And
yeah, and actually, yeah. Like, specifically in that case, I've heard on interviews with Green Party activists, people who at the time of the UK general election were complaining that Labour was getting too much credit for Green policies. Because they were basically like, these aspects of the Labour Green policies are really bad and not progressive enough. And you're like, oh, okay, that's kind of, you know, reasonable criticism. I think you've a similar kind of you've a divide here that is more indicative of Green parties as a whole, where you've ended up with a leadership. Like, so my opinion on Eamon Ryan is that Eamon Ryan has, like, particular environmental causes that he now considers to be deal breakers and is willing to put, like, make concessions on most things, but there's a few things that he views as, like, the most important aspects of his goal, where the younger membership especially has kind of more joined the Green Party as a very progressive party that also focuses on climate things, as opposed to a party that can do whatever it wants as long as it focuses on climate things, which are very different goals. And there's a lot of aspects that, like, the younger membership would push for that trying to claim these things aren't intertwined is ludicrous, because they are. You can't realistically do things like carbon emission reduction without, like, very progressive public spending on infrastructure that's, like, cheap for everybody. it's a very different thing to be like, oh, we're gonna spend lots of money on just cycle lanes versus we're gonna have massive infrastructure spending on, like, really good trains for the country.
So speaking to that point, we actually had, there was a comment that I'm going to paraphrase now, because due to my technical rig up, I can't actually look it up. there was a comment by Saoirse McHugh, who is a Green Party member. She ran the last general election in Mayo and didn't do well there because Mayo was... The person who got the most votes in Mayo was, like... a Fine Gael party member who was recently the All-Ireland hurling champion. So, like, that's Mayo politics, I guess. The issue, like, the thing she pointed out, and is something I agree, as she put it very succinctly, is Green politics without, like, radical economic justice, without, like, free public transport, without infrastructure spending, the things you've mentioned, is not Green politics, it's just gardening. Which I thought was a very, very good and succinct way of putting it. But, like, yeah, I agree with that take. And she's probably the biggest voice in this. The people who are probably not going to vote this deal through, this part of the Green Party.
She's probably the most well known of the people who aren't, like, the kind of more on the fence people in the leadership.
She also has the respect of like basically every other nominally left-wing party.
Yes, in Ireland. There is somewhat of a consensus that if this were to pass, people like her would leave the party because, in effect, they'd be signing on to a lot of stuff that they're very against, or like very, very watered down versions of it that may actually like do more harm than good because you've wasted so much time, especially on green issues. Is always a big deal. There's some specific criticisms that I like found very useful, that most of which I found from interviews that Nessa Horrigan, who is the finance spokesperson for the Green Party, she's in the leadership, and effectively she's come out saying that I can't endorse this, and she's abstained on votes so far, and she may vote against it, or it might just not vote potentially. And people are kind of pointing out that, well, but you negotiated this deal, and her point is, for the people we were negotiating with, this is the best deal we possibly could have gotten. There's no kind of illusions that like we could, like, they could have walked away, sure, but effectively her position is, we got them to move on a lot of stuff they said they wouldn't move on. This is as far as we get them to move. I'm shocked we got this good a deal, but there's key problems in the deal that means that she can't, like, she doesn't want, like, to be tied to it, effectively. One of the things that, like, isn't a specific criticism to this deal, but I find quite notable, which I'd like to say up front, so I put a link to the clip in it. During one of the interviews she was given, when she was talking about the, like, how the financials of the proposed deal don't make sense, but, like, it's a program for government. It's not like a form of coalition agreement. Nothing's costed. There's not like a lot of figures in it. But her point is that all of the financial modeling that's used to kind of like roughly sketch this out, whether or not that's sound in the first place, she's pointed out that it assumes that effectively there will be a reasonable post-COVID recovery, which I mean potentially not, and there's no modeling for if there's no Brexit deal, which a lot of people are pointing out is like not an unreasonable expectation for there not to be a trade deal by January. Wouldn't be shocking to anyone. They'd be like, that's very frustrating, but it's not shocking based on the current positions and how the negotiations are going. And effectively, like, I find this most notable because the interviewer just kind of like looks the camera shocked and goes, is that true? And the other person in the interview, so it's like a kind of debatey style interview, is the current finance minister, who effectively just like stays silent for a couple of beats and then goes, oh well, sure, we haven't taken that into account in the modeling. That's not what the modeling assumes there'll be a trade deal. And just like the shock of the radio interviewer of just like, are you telling me you literally haven't considered this at all? And you're claiming that this will all just be fine? And he's just like, well, yeah, we haven't looked into it. It's just like, but I think and that goes to the main core of her point, which is you can't take most of this stuff on face value, because if you're assuming that everything will just be fine economically, despite the fact that everyone knows there's going to be a massive recession due to COVID initially, and that it will take time to come back, assuming that effectively none of the additional spending that is proposed in this program for government will happen, because they've also stipulated they're not going to raise taxes or anything, so you can't do both. And the fact that they're ignoring that there's a recession in order to make all this stuff works means that they've no intention of doing any of it. For some like specific things that she's complained about in it, so the emission reductions that they negotiated aren't bad if they were actually doing them. So it's 7% every year for 10 years, which would work out, compound up to 51% emission reductions by 2030, which is, you know, not a, like, one, it's not a completely unrealistic goal for a start, and then it's also not like a bad deal if that was the deal you were getting. Her problem about it is that she couldn't get them to move on, that that's averaged over 10 years. So effectively, if you get 10% 1 year, that means, or in like, if you get 10% next year, that means you can take some of your emissions off this year and assume you'll get 10% off next year. So she's saying that they're going to use this to backload and then get far less than 7% the first few years, but the government term's only 5 years, so they can play out the clock on that and get, say, no emission reductions if they wanted to for 5 years and claim they were doing lots of prep to get high emission reduction, but only if you re-elect them. And then inevitably they'll get re-elected and the Green Party will get screwed over and lose some seats, not be in the next government, and then they just won't adhere to the deal and they won't do the emission reductions because they've all backloaded them. So effectively the emission reduction stuff is just not viable. It's also like they're not, if the government is also has no money, has no additional money coming in because of the massive recession they're not accounting for and the potential for there be no trade deal with the UK, then like the idea that they're going to have 7% emission reduction at all at any point in the next 5 years is completely ludicrous, assuming this platform. Like, you need to have a lot more radical economic shifts in it, but effectively most of the deal is to like keep things trucking along the previous government's plans with this emission reduction stuff. She also said, like, she makes a big deal about like how the housing policy is effectively like just not even close to enough to what would actually be needed to solve any like the massive housing shortage there is in Ireland. It's a very like modest version of a policy that would do that. And once you compound that with, and you're also not explaining where you're going to get any of the money for this because you're saying you're not going to raise debt and you're not going to raise taxes. so I'm not sure how you think you're going to build 50,000 homes and cool. And you're not doing anything around legislation to protect renters or like make it easier to actually purchase houses and not like hilarious, with like no hilarious math having to be done. The taxation stuff is probably the worst aspect of it. So there's a couple of like bits I want to read out from the agreement. So they say that they effectively have this vague phrase about they will look at taxation if the government needs to raise money. But then they go on to say, in doing so, we'll focus on any tax rises on those taxes which tax behaviors, which with negative externalities, such as carbon tax, sugar tax, plastics, etc. So effectively they mean, so the Irish government has this very funny way of raising revenue, which is they just raise the price of cigarettes and alcohol every year to make
taxing.
Yeah, which is like, we can talk about this in another episode, maybe. Like, we do an episode on sin taxing generally as a concept because a lot of countries like doing it and they like doing it in very different ways, different merits, but the Irish government does often tend to do it in a, we had a shortfall in the budget, so we've raised the price of cigarettes again by this percentage, which we reckon will bring in this amount of money. So they're just doing it to raise money. It has nothing to do with, like in no way are they saying that, they're basically, the public health thing is a nice bonus, but this is a good way for us to stealth, have a regressive tax.
It is a regressive tax because I guess the thing that immediately puts it up as a con of, like, public health, is the fact that there's, as you said, you would like, if it was like before we started recording, that you would like it earmarked for, you know, dealing with the effects of cigarettes, sugar, alcohol, whatever the thing being syntaxed is. And they don't do that. Even if it's not directly from that money, they don't invest. Like, Ireland does not invest in these kind of like, helping people recover from alcoholism or helping people like, there is, I don't know any country actually, but Ireland in particular, there is no like public program to help people to stop smoking.
Not in the same way. The NHS has one that's much better in the UK compared to the absence of. It's very notable considering the absence of one on the same scale in Ireland. I don't think there's none, but there's not like. They're certainly not using the like enormous taxes they have on cigarettes to pay for it.
I know of like state funded or state assisted programs to help people deal with alcohol and heroin and other drugs, like addictive drugs like that, but like not cigarettes.
I
always got the impression that dealing with cigarette addiction is a personal endeavor. Buy nicotine patches, go cold turkey, that kind of thing. I've never really seen of a communal or state-backed effort to do that, but I think it's basically telling that like the idea that we're doing syntaxing for public health cause is like, okay, but why aren't you doing any of the other parts? Because the effect and the reason why I really do not like syntaxing is that the effect of this is everyone who smokes or drinks or now I guess likes sugary foods is just driven into poverty. This is pretty much very noticeable with Ireland's like alcoholism problem, that it's like it's something that results in like people missing various payments and being kicked out of their homes and massive spikes in homelessness and things like that.
Yeah, and this is there's like a non-zero amount of research around. So when they introduced sugar tax in the UK, which is largely on, I think it's only on sugary drinks effectively now.
Yeah,
but like the idea of having a broad sugar tax, the problem with that is that high sugar foods, like cheaper and more convenient food, often tends to have more sugar in it. And if you have a general sugar, like amount of sugar in a thing equals more tax thing, then effectively you're just taxing poorer people's food, because that is either the food they can afford or the food they have time to make.
Your ready meals.
Yeah. And if you just, you're basically, it like effectively you are just then taxing the people who you think you're taxing, who are people who you view as lazy or have bad diets, but you're also taxing people who either don't have time or money so you've created this cycle. So you do, like, you are technically doing the thing you think you're doing, but you're not, like, whether that has merit is up for debate, but you're also having this awful, awful side effect, which is makes it completely not worthwhile. And same with plastics, like cheaper things tend to have more plastic in them. So if by plastics they mean we're going to have a plastic bottle charge, which then the companies will then pass on to people, but we're not going to have any recycling program like Germany's one where you can get the money, the surcharge back if you recycle. If they just have a plastic tax, then you're like, things that are now cheaper and therefore you can afford them will now be more expensive, so maybe you can't afford them. And also, the alternative that's not made of plastic is too expensive for you anyway.
Yes. And this is I just don't know how diabetes works enough, but like I feel like sugar tax is probably a little detrimental to anyone dealing with diabetes. Right?
They
control their sugar intake and putting these like new price points at certain things. I don't know.
Yeah, part of the public health argument for a sugar tax would be it would in theory reduce the rate of type 2 diabetes.
But that's not but that's not
the, yes exactly yeah exactly that's yeah. That's the thing, because again they're explicitly saying in this in the section where they're like, if we need money, this is how we could raise money.
Jesus Christ.
But they go on to also say that they want to have a medium term roadmap detailing how Ireland will reduce the deficit and return to a broadly balanced budget. So in that line, in the previous line, they've ruled out like income tax rises effectively, because they're like, before we even discuss any tax rises, we're going to focus on introducing sin taxes. And then also we're going to balance the budget. So effectively they're saying, well, we need to introduce the sin taxes to balance the budget, but then they're not explaining how they're going to pay for any of the like housing plans that they claim they have in there, which like are watered down to begin with. But then on top of that, they've in no way explained how that will be paid for, or like admitted in any way that like that would take precedence. They've said that like one of the focuses of the government is deficit control, which is like, as we've discussed before and many people discuss in many places, is like a massive bullshit position to be taking, especially now because interest rates are so low and it would be so advantageous for Ireland to raise lots of debt on the bond market to effectively spend their way out of what is going to be a massive recession. They're almost explicitly saying in this what is supposed to be like a move to the left for Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael that they're ruling that out. So, I mean, it's unclear how they're going to do any of the progressive stuff they said they're going to do.
Also, like, we're in this weird position where I think the weird kind of shambolic position we're in is Ireland is like supposedly getting a unity government. The reason we're talking about the Greens more so, I think, is actually because the fact that Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael will agree to this deal is already a kind of a done deal. It's spoken for. The Greens may not agree to this because getting a 2/3 majority is what they require of their membership to pass this deal.
Mm-hmm.
And right before we start recording, there was a tweet from Virgin Media News, which, first of all, it really sucks that's a thing now. Virgin Media News. That's like a actual tour de force in Irish politics. Fucking hell. But anyway. But like, there was interviews outside Leinster House of Eamon Ryan and a representative, I can't remember what she her exact title was, but she's a representative of the membership. And she's a representative of, she's a representative of the opposition to this deal within the membership.
So
Eamon Ryan was like, Eamon Ryan basically made the comment being like, I don't think we're going to get this. You know, it's not a done deal. A two-thirds majority, it could not work out in our favor. And the person, the representative, was like, being wiped out in a subsequent election is not a good enough reason for us to vote for this. Because that's the thing that's been like held over their head, is that they'll probably be wiped out for basically everything Eamon Ryan has done. It's not really their fault, because Eamon Ryan has also been like woefully unable to read the room, like the proverbial room that is 2020. Because his response to like this became a bit of a memeable moment on Irish Twitter, but like his response to the COVID-19 kind of like relief for people who have like lost their jobs and are trapped indoors was to make sure they have sun-facing windows so they can grow some of their own tomatoes and lettuce at home.
So the source from a Q joke really holds, because he wants to have gardening. Yeah.
It's just gardening. And then there was also the moment he had a heated gamer moment where he said the N-word in the Dáil recently. He since apologized, and to be fair to him, he did use it in the kind of like quote context.
Yeah, it was part of a quote.
Yeah, it wasn't him using it with vitriol or whatever, but like people are still like, you can just say the N-word. Like, just say the N-word. like the actual N-W-O-R-D. Like,
for sure.
Because like it doesn't undercut the point you were making, because he was talking about racism in Ireland.
No, especially if it's going in like the parliamentary record of your country.
People were like, apparently it was the last time it's been said in the Dáil since the 50s. And I was like, I wonder what that was like.
Yeah, it's not great.
Yeah.
I think the reason I wanted to talk about this in detail was because it is indicative of, this is what the Manfred Weber of the EPP party in the European Parliament was effectively saying, like, to prime the Trump in German politics, that like having a green coalition, like a green center-right coalition, is like the way forward and the way we should be doing politics in Europe, because you get both German fiscal conservatism and also some environmental policies which will save the planet. And the point of like younger green activists is that that's a terrible idea, because it'll just do the first thing. You won't get the second thing done at all. There'll be like the kind of green policies which effectively are gardening. They're gardening in some other form. They're like, oh, we had like an extra couple of bike lanes in this city that's very visible to people, or we updated this bus to be like a hybrid. You're like, well, that doesn't. Or we have like a if you buy a new car, you can get a tax break if you get a hybrid car, an electric car, and you're like, that's not really on the scale of the problem. Aren't you arguing that it's such an emergency that you need to do like something serious about it? And you're like, when people buy new cars, you're like, people do not buy new cars at the rate you seem to be pretending they do. And the infrastructure you're adding is like so minor and so cheap that it's not like it's not the actual change people who are voting for green parties want. It's like a really sanitized version of it, and this is the way they do it. Like, this deal is exactly what Weber was talking about, is you can integrate green policies in as like afterthoughts to exist like other policies. So they're saying, with all these stipulations, we'll then aim, this will be our goal, and we'll get the Green Party attached to it, so therefore no one can complain that we're not taking it seriously. It's giving them cover. Like, it's giving them very, very difficult to argue against cover, because you're like, well, all the green policy experts are assigned onto this for some reason. But it's because, like, when you hear Eamon Ryan, like, as in, I think, you know, more cynically, you could kind of view Eamon Ryan as, like, a careerist politician type who doesn't, like, have a lot of principles.
And you'd be correct.
Well, yeah. I disagree to an extent that I think he has principles, but I think he's, you know, talked himself into the position that he's actually going to get any of the stuff he wants done. He thinks like a lesser version of it will be like, there'll be some lesser version of it that gets done that he'll be able to be like, oh, at least I did that. But in practice, he's probably going to get none of what he wants. And he'll have to do, when you hear him interviewed now, when he gets asked directly by people, oh, do you not think you're just screwing the Green Party over? Because you're not going to get anything you want, and you're going to be tied to this awful government. And he'll effectively then have to defend the previous coalition he was a part of and name like really specific instances where he convinced the Fianna Fáil at the time to do something slightly less bad. And use that as like a thing, but like, oh, but if we weren't there, then it would have been fine. It's like, yeah, but you set the Green Party back like 10 years by doing it. So it's not, you're not getting what you think you're getting out of it.
Yeah.
But he seems to have convinced himself in that there, he seems to think that everyone in the room agrees with him that there's like a different economic consensus that austerity is bad. But they've like they've more subtly put it into the agreement as opposed to being like, front and center, we're cutting government spending. They're just being like, oh, we also need to consider that government spending can't go up. You're like, that's the same thing, you just made it sound a bit nicer. And that's enough to trick Eamon Ryan, apparently. But
One of the things that kind of like came out of this, or that I found very, should say about this kind of response, and also one other piece of like contextual information, which is, so a lot of this, like, because Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are working together, a lot of people have been calling this a unity government. And to a certain extent, I think that's fine. To another extent, since it doesn't include Sinn Féin, I also don't think it's fine. Mm-hmm. Because, like, sure, in classical politics, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael are, like, the two major parties. But this election, it's like, Sinn Féin is a major third player. And, like, arguably on policy positions, or at least we can talk about like how much Sinn Féin would actually stick to their policy positions or whatever, but like even on the on paper policy positions between these parties, there is a world of difference between what Sinn Féin supposedly wants versus what Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil want. But besides that, anyway, kind of one of the reactions that came out of this was so a good account to follow on Twitter is Next Irish GE, Next Irish General Election. They do kind of like, they're like one-stop shop for like Irish polling, just like aggregated on this Twitter feed. And there was a 3-round question asked on like, hey, like, which would you prefer if the deal falls through, right? Mm. And with it was basically a round system of like reducing options each round.
Yeah.
They would take out the least popular option. And in all 3 rounds, over 50% went to another general election.
Mm.
Like, there's a lot to be said about like people in the opposition parties, or like what are would be the opposition parties if this thing shook out, are saying that the will of the people isn't being like adhered to. The last election sent like a fairly clear message that the parties who are now trying to be in government are not really the parties people want.
Yeah.
And
it's also like not mathematically a unity government in any sense, because like Fianna Fáil plus Fine Gael plus the Green Party is like, is it a really slim majority? Like it's a,
so
yeah, I think it's like a, that's a 37 plus 35, 60, 72. Yes, it's a very slim majority.
Yeah.
So you're basically like, it's a unity government. You know, we have like 55% of the votes.
Yeah.
That's not a unity government would be like a supermajority. You have like a slim majority on very shaky ground where you're having to screw over 12 seats worth of people.
Where's the gross of your gross coalition is not there.
No.
Like
an actual unity government would be Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael and Sinn Féin would be the unity government. Because that would be like a sizable large majority. But obviously that would never happen. That's crazy.
Yeah, but it's also it would exist for the purposes of unity.
Yes.
Of like, we are here because there is like a multi-pronged crisis happening the world over. Mm-hmm. Not not the like what is effectively Irish a political equivalent of the will they won't they Fianna Fáil Fine Gael thing, which is like they've effectively been the same party since the Anglo-Irish treaty question has been resolved and everyone kind of agreed the North exists but we would like it, thanks. So like what is their difference?
I really think just like the again going back to Nessa Horgan's various interviews on this that I've watched, where when she just seems like really, you know, frustrated that she can't get it clearly enough across that the doing all of the things in the program for government is not possible, and pretending it's possible is just lying to people, and the thing that will be cut is the Green Party stuff, which is not that much of it. So effectively all you're getting is a centre-right programme for government that the Green Party has to agree to for some reason, because unity, which is not unity, that's basically being like, you need to do what we want even though we're the minority. It's like, that's not, yeah. And this is the thing, this is a version of this will probably happen. If there's a German election anytime soon, I suspect that would be what would happen in a German election. The Green Party would make gains, and there could be even some sort of rainbow coalition of various right parties and the business Greens, and then all the people in the Green Party in Germany who want, like, you know, them to actually take seriously emission reduction, they'll be like, yes, fine, but we're going to do what the car companies want, so we're not doing that. And that's there's a potential for that to happen in a lot of countries where there's like reasonable green movements, but if that's not the actual focus, then your stuff is going to get cut. And if people are like, you know, that having a Green Party as a third party in a coalition is not good, unless it's a party that's also, you know, has a good green policy, but that's not the case here. I think that's the key thing. Like, having red-green coalitions is a very different conversation, because you can have a, you know, Sock Dem-style party that has a reasonable green position that the Green Party, if it moves it left on, sounds good. But it's not good, is my consensus. But it's also happening, so we decided to talk about it.
So, we'll see how this turns out, but, like, the general history is the Greens weren't able to handle Fianna Fáil by themselves. So I don't understand why they think they can handle Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael. And sure, slightly weakened positions, but finally combined, working together. Yeah. It's like when War Garurumon co-digivolved with War Great. Well, it's end the podcast. That was another episode of Previously in Europe. Previously in Europe is recorded and produced by Hugh O'Brien and Kieran Dold. If you like the show, you can leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. That'd be great. A 4 or 5 star review with some text written down would be seriously appreciated. If you've done that already and you still want to help us out, then if there's someone in your life that you think would like the podcast, tell them about it. Word of mouth really helps a lot. And lastly, one of the best ways you can support us is on Patreon, patreon.com/previouslyineurope. There you can donate a certain amount of money and we will shout your name out of the podcast. Usually, due to technical difficulties, I can't actually shout out the names of people right now, but I will next week. So don't worry, you're all still really cool and cool cats, but today I can't shout you out. I'm really sorry. Also, lastly, you can find us on basically all social media, like Twitter. We're on Twitter at PrevInEurope, P-R-E-V in Europe. We have a Gmail account, previouslyineurope@gmail.com. We have a Facebook group that if you join, if you don't look like a bot, we'll let you in. And lastly, you can find all of this stuff, like Discord groups, subreddit, all that kind of stuff, previouslyineurope.eu. Thanks for listening.